Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. My name is Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. How's it going out there, all my Bitcoiners, all around the world, wherever you are? Thanks for joining me again today here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. Today, a great episode with a friend of mine, an old Bitcoiner OG. He helped me get into the space and understand Bitcoin and what was going on here. Really owe a lot to him for that. Ansel Lindner is in the house. Before we get into this episode, let's hear about Swan. It's been an incredible year for Swan. We launched March 31st of this year. We are not even a year old yet. We've had an incredible response from the community, amazing support. I think there was really a place for a Bitcoin-only auto-stacking on-ramp focused on education and really just implementing Bitcoiner best practices. And I think we've done a good job of that so far. We have a lot more to do. And we've released some big product updates lately. We've got a brand new onboarding flow that is one of the best in the industry. Continue to receive great reviews about that process. Super easy, super simple. So when you want to onboard your friends and family, just know that it's going to be a really smooth process. We're really proud of what we've built there. We also just launched Buy Now Instant Buys. They're on your dashboard. Anybody who's got a Swan account, you can find that on your dashboard. Available, of course, for anybody who creates a new account. And, you know, we do think that automatic recurring buys is the best way to accumulate Bitcoin. It's safe. You'll smooth out that cost basis. But we know, we've heard you every once in a while. You just want to buy now. You want to smash that buy button on the dips or sometime when you listen to an incredibly bullish podcast. You feel inspired. We get it. I like to do the same thing. So now you can smash buy on Swan, which is really cool. Well, we also have an increasing number of companies coming to us to help them stack for their corporate treasuries. So we are serving companies big and small, and that trend is definitely real. It's not just the big companies that you hear about in the headlines. Small and medium-sized businesses are following suit as well. Excuse me. We also support wires now, wire transfers directly from your bank. So if you want to stack a larger amount, over 10K, and we support up to $10 million, we can probably source Bitcoin for you even over that number. We've seen several million-dollar plus wires coming into Swan. Big money's coming in too, so it's awesome to see that. You can wire directly to your account. If you decide you want to get into Bitcoin, you got a chunk of fiat, you want to start establishing your position, I think it's a really good idea just to throw a big chunk on the table, and a wire into Swan is a good way to do that, and then you set up your auto-recurring plan as well. Of course, make sure you check out our educational efforts on our blog, swanbitcoin.com/signal, and youtube.com/swansignal. And then, of course, we have a podcast at swansignalpodcast.com. All right, also shout out to Let's Talk Bitcoin Network. Bitcoin 2021 coming up, end of April, early May. There's a backup plan if that can't happen due to pandemic lockdown stuff, but looks like we're on the other side, light at the end of the tunnel. So maybe we'll be able to squeeze that in. If not, there is a backup plan. So check out Bitcoin 2021 conference. I think it's at bitcoinconf.com. And Bitcoin Magazine, BTC Media in general. Shout out. Let's Talk Bitcoin Network. Letstalkbitcoin.com. All right, let's dive in. Ansel Lindner has been in Bitcoin for a long time. He has one of the longest running Bitcoin podcasts that's still going strong, Bitcoin and Markets. I highly recommend it. Ansel has studied economics in college and really continued his education. He found Austrian economics early, has a deep understanding of macro, and really impressed with what he's been able to accomplish. And his podcast, like I said, it was one of the only around in 2017 because podcasts like Stefan and Marty and Matt and Peter McCormick didn't really launch their podcasts until the end of 2017. And of course, this podcast launched in early 2018. So that's really when the Bitcoin podcast scene started blowing up. But Ansel has been there since 2016, dropping knowledge. Check that archive out. These days, he gives 20, 30 minute or so updates on what's going on in the markets, fundamentals of the Bitcoin network, etc. He's an awesome guy. And, you know, it was just time to sit down and chat with him again. He was the second interview on this podcast way back when. All right. So here's my conversation with Ansel. Hope you all enjoy. All right. Welcome back to the Citizen Bitcoin podcast. Still relatively new to doing this live on YouTube, but excited here to be with Ansel Lindner. Ansel, welcome, man. How's it going?
I'm great, Brady. Thanks for inviting me. I'm looking forward to this.
Me too. So Ansel is a longtime Bitcoiner. He has one of the longest running Bitcoin podcasts called Bitcoin and Markets, and it's fantastic. It's usually pretty short. You know, you can get it in 20, 30 minutes. I listen to it every week. He's got some cool stuff going now where he comments on some other media that gets played, which I really enjoy those episodes. And honestly, Ansel, I got to say your podcast, Bitcoin and Markets, played a big role in 2017 for me to really educating me, especially about all the shitcoin scams. And you were really on top of calling out that stuff.
Oh, thanks, man. It feels good when you work hard on something and it makes a difference. So thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely made a big difference for me. And it kind of kicked me off onto the right path. And, you know, here I am. It's been, three and a half years now. I was tweeting out to the class of 2017 that we made it through this bear market. Here we are at 23,000. And it was a ton of actually fun. It was actually fun. Podcasting, learning. Yeah, I love the bear market. This is going to be bonkers over the next year, but the bear market was good. I met a lot of people and made a lot of content, and it was good, productive. I don't know how productive this is going to be.
No, you are making waves. So if I can be one iota of that success that you guys are having there, I'm happy to be a part of that.
Yeah, man. Appreciate it. Well, we've had a massive year. We're here at the end of the year, and I thought it'd be a lot of fun to get you on the show. You were the second podcast guest after Hodlnut of this podcast. And I was like, hey, I got to get Ansel on, talk about this crazy year, talk about some macro. You have a view on how inflation versus deflation is going to play out, and it's contrarian to the sort of the view that most Bitcoiners are holding and talking about. And so I think that's going to be interesting. We're going to talk about that as well. So the first big event of 2020 for Bitcoin happened with the response, the pandemic really hitting hard, the massive drop in the stock markets, equity markets. Of course, it affected Bitcoin as well. And we dropped from something like 9K all the way down to little like 3.5, 3.6, 3.8, something like that. And it was a tough day on some Bitcoiners. How were you feeling that day, and how did you handle it?
Oh, man. Well, I had been commenting on the coming like pandemic or virus because I've been watching a lot of stuff from China, you know, all the way back in early January. I think Tour de Meester and some others were posting about it on Twitter. And so I was kind of prepared for it. I went a little bit overboard and did a bunch of prepping and all that kind of stuff, because I thought, you know, I mean, rightfully, that we were going to be in the middle of lockdowns for a long time. Where I happen to live, we didn't suffer. I think we had maybe a week or two where most things were closed down, but the lockdowns didn't affect me personally, but a lot of people did. And so Bitcoin specifically, what I thought was interesting was just how correlated it was with everything else. Bitcoin is a, you know, uncorrelated asset almost completely to almost any other asset. I mean, gold may be a little bit correlated, but everything fell at the same time. So that was, I think, my biggest takeaway from that day was, in these type of market panic sell-offs, Bitcoin is going to be correlated to everything. The dollar was still king on that day. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's going to be that way for quite a while. And I think people had to flee to dollars and obviously sold off the Bitcoin, but it came back pretty quickly. So that was March 13th. We launched Swan on March 30th, and it was already back up to like 6K where it had been for most of the bear market. And then just another couple weeks later, maybe a month later, it was all the way back up to 9K. So I think the same thing happened, right? The response from the Fed was just a flood of money and accessible money, credit, as you call it, right? It's not printing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was really lucky that we were this close to the halving in March. Because the halving really helped slingshot it back up, I think. I mean, I'm not saying that we would have gone further down or anything, but it might have taken a little bit longer to get back up if the halving wasn't so close. And yeah, it just went right on into that. Because when was the halving? Was that May, I think? So real, real quick on the heels of the March sell-off came the halving. And so I think that was the next biggest story of 2020 was the halving.
I agree completely. Another halving, another celebration of the protocol, just executing flawlessly block after block, came and went without a hitch. Bitcoin Magazine, shout out to CK and the team over there, put together an amazing 24-hour stream. That was a ton of fun. You are now with Bitcoin Magazine on FedWatch. We can talk about that here in a little bit. But so the halving, what significance does the halving hold for you? Obviously, you know, it's a very important part of the protocol and just the rhythm of Bitcoin. Do you think it has a lot of effect on price cycles? What do you think about it in general?
Yeah, I think it's very important for price cycles. It drives its own hype cycle, and hype draws people in and they buy and stuff. So, I think it does help a lot. Plus, I mean, the reduction in new issuance is going to cause a shortage in the market, at least to some degree, that is going to, you know, slowly get baked into the price. But it's also, I think, each halving that goes on is going to be like show how rock solid and unchangeable Bitcoin is. This one was from 12.5 to 6.25. So that's a less of a drop than from 50 down to 25, but the confidence that's being built increases every time. So I think there will be a decreasing like supply effect, but an increasing confidence effect as we go forward. And yeah, I think it's very, very important to the price for sure.
So this is a place where I have a little, probably more of a contrarian opinion than most Bitcoiners as well. I've been thinking about it this year, and this was really post-halving thinking. So two things. One, the liquidity that Bitcoin has is pretty high liquidity. There's several million coins usually available on the market at any given time since being traded and batted back and forth. I think we'll talk about this in a little bit too. I think that that's actually going to be decreasing soon for other reasons besides the issuance. So to me, I wonder if the issuance actually has that much of an impact, especially as it's decreasing, because it's more of a drop in the liquidity bucket. What do you think about that?
I mean, yeah, you can argue that point. I think that there is a large OTC market as well. And so all of this liquidity, seen and unseen, goes on. And it is 900 Bitcoins a day, that much of a difference? Maybe not in one day. But if you add up that shortage over many thousands of Bitcoins over months and months, that's when it really makes a difference. So, it's a cumulative effect. And that's why, you know, right at the halving, it doesn't pop up. The stock to flow model has it popping straight up and then going horizontal. The price actually has to accumulate that effect, and then it skyrockets after that. So,
yeah, I guess it adds up very quickly, actually, to be tens of thousands of Bitcoins pretty quickly. So yeah, that does make sense to me. And we're seeing the spike go now. And you know, another big thing that happened this year was big investors, Paul Tudor Jones, really kicked it off in May. And he said, you know, he's buying Bitcoin as a hedge against inflation. Stan Druckenmiller came earlier, just a couple of months ago. And right in between, we had August 11th, MicroStrategy buying, what was it, $450 million of the Bitcoin with their treasury reserves, and then stacking on top of that a couple of weeks ago with $650 million in debt issuance from based on the corporate debt issuance and buying Bitcoin. So this is a massive deal. We've got these big players. We've got institutions too, even insurance companies that are typically extremely conservative coming in and buying big chunks of Bitcoin. And I think that these are stronger hands than the retail investors and the traders that we had in 2017 really driving up the price. So what do you think about a lot more coins being held for the long term over this next couple of years? How do you think that will affect Bitcoin's price cycles through history so far?
Yeah, I think you can see a difference between 2013, 14, 15, say, when people were worried about, oh, is Amazon going to accept Bitcoin? Is PayPal going to accept Bitcoin? You know, are all these other things, where can we spend our Bitcoin? And now the narrative has totally shifted 100% from acceptance to holding.
Yep.
And I've said for a long time that, you know, first we need to get the price up, right? You need to build up price to have a big pool of money to spend. So if you only have a $10 billion market cap or a $1 billion market cap, that's just not a lot of capital to spend out there, especially if you're talking about PayPal or something. So, but mm-hmm. once you get to $1 trillion market cap, oh my gosh, now you have Bitcoiners that want to spend their Bitcoin and they have a lot more to spend. And so the holding and buying comes first, acceptance comes second. So I think we kind of saw a big shift in that, of course, this year. I was surprised at how quickly it went from nobody to Paul Tudor Jones. I mean, he just like went out, came out of the blue, you know, the biggest names in investing were coming out on the side of Bitcoin just out of the blue. So I thought that was very interesting. I kind of expected it to be maybe, you know, some smaller people or people approaching specialists in the space and saying, hey, you know, can you come speak to our boards or can you come do some teaching of our wealth advisors or something like this? I thought it would be like a slow gradual thing, but all of a sudden it's Paul Tudor Jones, Michael Saylor buying $1 billion worth of Bitcoin. And it's pretty crazy.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've got to credit Bitcoin education. And there's so much available out there. And, you know, it started really back in 2015, 2016. The perceived top podcasts in Bitcoin, Tales from the Crypt and Stefan's podcast, What Bitcoin Did, probably the most downloaded three, I would imagine, unless I forgot one there. They didn't really start until late 2017. So there wasn't this nearly as much education out there in 2017. You know, it was like, I watched some Andreas videos. Those were out there. I was listening to Bitcoin to Markets. You know, and there was a lot of stuff on Twitter. There was Nakamoto Institute, and there was a lot of stuff going on Twitter. So you sort of had to piece things together on your own, and there was a ton of noise going on. But you're coming in 2020, and you're looking for Bitcoin education. There's signals all over the web now pointing you toward the right places. And that's why someone like Michael Saylor was able to come up to speed in a few months and develop enough conviction to buy $1 billion of the Bitcoin. So, I mean, I think we got to credit that. And I think it's going to have a massive effect over the next year or two as, you know, moving people straight from, you know, no coiner to Bitcoiner and right past the shitcoiner phase.
Yeah, it's also just we had the Bitcoin standard. When did that come out? 2018 or something? So that was a big shot in the arm, I think, for Bitcoin education.
Absolutely.
But it's also just quantity too. So you might have had a good few sources of information previously, but the quantity now. So when you go and search on Google, the best stuff rises to the top, right? You're not diluted with diluted with the Forbes and MarketWatch and all these other people FUDding on Bitcoin. You're surrounded by good quality information and sources. So I agree. That's a big difference.
Yeah. I'm seeing it all the time on CNBC, almost every day now, to the point where I got a YouTube TV subscription so I could kind of have it on in the background and start clipping out bullish content from CNBC. So yeah, it's driving people like Peter Schiff crazy. Did you see that that exchange between him and his son a couple days ago?
A couple days ago? No, I heard that his son was a Bitcoiner, and that kind of caused some family animosity.
Yeah, his son is a Bitcoiner. Spencer Schiff is his name, and so he buys Bitcoin. He's tweeted about it a little bit a couple days ago. Somebody tweeted out like, "Hey, tag somebody in this thread who needs to learn more about Bitcoin," and it had some Bitcoin education stuff up there. And Spencer Schiff just tags, just the tweet was all just at Peter Schiff. That's all it said.
That is hilarious.
Just like a perfect understated troll of his dad. And you know, it's the all-time high day is when it came out, and then Peter Schiff responds with some more like tirades against, you know, Bitcoin, you know, whales are going to dump and the bubble's going to, you know, burst here any minute. There's no hope that it's going to go up to $400,000. Everyone's crazy. So I know you were a gold bug back in the day, cause you got into Austrian Econ pretty early. And so when you came into Bitcoin, you were primed to understand it. How has your understanding of gold or your feelings about gold changed over the last few years since you became a Bitcoiner?
Oh man. Well, I do own gold. I do own gold. I think it's an altcoin. I think it's one of the better altcoins. and so I still respect Peter Schiff. Like, we were just talking about Peter Schiff. I did an episode on him, I don't know, a month ago or so. And I think he's done wonders for sound money people, for education and stuff like that. But I think there is, I don't know. I also am upset with the Austrian school because they just refuse to dive past the surface of Bitcoin. And so I think they're, I was just answering a question today on my Discord, someone was like, why do there's some freedom oriented people that like Bitcoin and there's some freedom oriented people that think it's a CIA plot, you know? And so what is the difference? And I said, well, I think it's just tech savviness. There's some people that are a little bit more tech savvy. They understand kind of how computers work, how the internet works a little bit better. And they're more willing to learn more about Bitcoin. And then once you go down that road and you kind of accept some things, then it becomes very easy to understand. So I don't know. Does that make sense? Do you think it's like a tech savvy difference between people?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, tech savvy and maybe also just trusting technology. I think the gold bugs are mostly older, you know, boomers and older at this point. So that certainly, you know, leads me to think that the hypothesis is correct. You know, the younger crowd, like you look at some of these surveys, Coinmetrics or CoinDesk, I can't remember who issued it, but every 18 months or so, they'll do a phone survey, kind of like a, you know, if you're doing a political survey or something like that, and they'll talk to thousands of people and just do random cold calls. And the number of millennials and Gen Xers basically anybody like under 40 or so were vastly, vastly more trusting of Bitcoin than the older crowd, and indicating like they're planning to buy some if they haven't already. 30% already had some, something like that, even a little bit, or had bought some, played with it or whatever. And that, I mean, yeah, those obviously digital natives get it. I mean, they've been growing up playing with tokens on video games for a long time, right? I mean, seeing that they actually have real world value and people were trading it for avatars and things like that. So I think you're presented with this idea of internet native money and you're just like, oh yeah, I could see that working. Makes sense to me. So yeah, I think tech savviness, being able to trust technology, is a massive hurdle. We are seeing a lot more boomers come in. However, like I've been shocked at Swan, the number of customers coming in who are boomers, and there's a lot of money there. So I think as number go up, like you were saying earlier, that's going to build a lot of trust, and maybe it'll get them over that tech trust hurdle a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. I think, yeah, you guys are in a great position to know exactly who's coming in and what the demographics are, and people are going to not be able to ignore it. So, yep.
Yep, absolutely. So, all right, we have, let's just talk about some of these big investors that have come in and their significance in the ecosystem, just like the economy and in the American just finance world. We have, let's see if I can go in order here. I might not be able to go in order. So these have been over the last couple of months. We've had Guggenheim Fund, and the Guggenheim Fund is massive. They filed with the SEC for the ability to invest $500 million in Grayscale, which is 10% of its net asset value. That was November 28th. And Guggenheim's huge. They are one of the bigger names in the system. And I could just, I don't know, this is a big one. This is one of the bigger ones.
What do you think about Grayscale? Like,
yeah, I was going to ask that next.
It's consolidating so much of the Bitcoin.
It does make me nervous. I got to say that. I don't like Bitcoin being centralized in one location and not in the hands of the actual holders. So all these people have exposure to the Bitcoin price, USD Bitcoin price, but they don't actually hold the Bitcoin.
It makes me something uneasy, but I don't know why. Like it shouldn't make me uneasy, because Bitcoin will, you know, in a good money, in a sound money, you mm-hmm. earn your Bitcoin. So that Bitcoin will eventually flow out if it has to, right? So it shouldn't bother somebody. Yeah, it makes me uneasy for some reason that they're getting so big.
Yeah. So I was, Max Kaiser brought this up the other day when I was talking to him, and he said one thing that makes him uneasy about Grayscale is, you know, the U.S. is probably going to be slower to act than most other countries, just because, you know, we have the world reserve currency. We have less incentive as a Federal Reserve Bank and U.S. Treasury to, you know, start buying Bitcoin for the national or the corporate or the Fed Treasury, United States Treasury. So if a bunch of other countries are stacking and, you know, starting to mine and all that, and America falls behind, one thing they could do is just go to Barry and be like, hey, we're nationalizing Grayscale, and because we need this Bitcoin to compete on the world stage. And, you know, as a good patriot, Barry, we know that you'll understand this. And, you know, we'd love to keep you on the team to help administer our Bitcoin, you know. So that's one thing that you could see as a risk, right? It's, you know, it's kind of a 60-102 situation, but it would be a lot easier to execute if you have, you know, all of that gold centralized.
Yeah, we'll make your investors all whole with dollars, but we're going to take the Bitcoin.
Exactly.
Yeah, I can see that, and that's actually might be one of these guards against everybody else, right? So they are going to, that's such a honeypot that they're going to attack that before they attack somebody else's multi-sig, right? With just a few Bitcoins in it. So that might be actually a good thing, that it's kind of like a moat, if you will, because I mean, it's going to happen. We told people that if you centralize Bitcoin in a trusted third party, it's going to get taken. People know the risks. And so it sucks that it will happen most likely, I think, but hey, we warned them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, what do you think will be the outcome of that? I mean, do you think it'll be devastating for Bitcoin? Do you think that there will be, we're already seeing talk of bills in the legislature. It's another big thing that happened this year in the last couple of months that are ostensibly focused on stable coins, but are written broadly as most laws are, to allow for a lot of enforcement opportunities after the bill is passed, to make self-custody Bitcoin basically illegal. Well, you know, you have to KYC if you're going to hold in your own wallet. So every wallet has to be KYC'd. Or even worse, you can't withdraw from your bank or your exchange. You only have the USD value of the Bitcoin itself. And that's all you have access to. That could be that could definitely be a problem. And I could see, you know, this corporate custodied KYC'd Bitcoin becoming sort of separate from this self-custodied, you know, even Bitcoin that we all have, you know, in multi-sig wallets or whatever that might be harder to seize. And then we've got two different kind of a white listed Bitcoin and a black market Bitcoin. Does that, I mean, do you see that as happening pretty likely? And how does that affect Bitcoin as a money, as a store of value, as a network?
Well, I think it's pretty unlikely, actually. I think if we, as we go forward, we will see things coming. And this kind of ties into my whole like deflation or I guess CBDC type take is that we will see this coming. They won't just change overnight, right? And we've even seen, even on the CBDC side of things, we've seen like the ECB say, oh no, this is not to compete with cash. It's supposed to be a complement with cash. And now the Chinese, I don't know, chief or something of the PBOC came out recently and said, no, this is not to replace cash. So I think that, you know, it's incremental steps and we will see something big like that coming down to the against the self-hosted wallets. That's like throwing a grenade. And I just don't think that they would do that at least anytime soon. I mean, we would see it coming a long time, maybe 5-10 years out, and we'd be able to build stuff around it before it became an issue anyway. And the government would know that. So they're always 4 or 5 years behind. So Bitcoin just needs to keep moving forward and we'll be fine.
What are your thoughts on the ability of Bitcoiners to make a difference politically through the political process in the U.S.? We already have a couple of, you know, out public holders, right? We just elected Wyoming elected a senator, Cynthia Lummis. She's going to be in the Senate in this next, you know, in January. She's a Bitcoiner. She's a real Bitcoiner. I think her son-in-law is Parker Lewis, you know, at Unchained. So she's pretty well educated. Of course, we have Warren Davidson of Bitcoin, not shitcoin fame, putting that into the Congressional Record. Patrick McHenry, I believe it is, who's the other vocal advocate of Bitcoin. So as, you know, as politicians become holders and they are incentivized to protect their bags, what do you see as the possibility of, you know, just a minority, a vocal minority, really making a big difference in our political process?
I don't think really the Congress people make the laws. I think it's more like the black money behind them, right? The dark money. So if you get the trillionaires and the trillionaire banks, bankers, CEOs, these types of people on board, the government can't do anything. So, yes, we have a few Congress people that have owned Bitcoin or are favorable to Bitcoin or friendly to Bitcoin, but, I don't think that really matters. I mean, it does display the unique thing about Bitcoin is that it works on an individual basis. So I've used this example a lot. So a banker might sit in a board meeting and say, I don't think it's right for the bank to get involved with the Bitcoin. And then they go home and buy some, right? So the incentives work on the individual to front run everything. So it does make sense and it does follow with the individual incentives that Bitcoin has. So I don't know. I used to be really worried about it as a gold bug. I was really worried about 6102 and worried about the government coming in and really trying to screw with us. But the more that this goes on and the bigger Bitcoin gets, I get less and less worried about anything like that.
What do you think about privacy measures beyond holding your own keys, which is not really a privacy measure, but just a prevention against seizure or censorship? Do you think that it's important to mix coins and do these coin join things? And there's all kinds of other, you know, sort of privacy protocols that are being developed now. Do you think that's important?
Oh yeah, 100%. I think it's not only important for the person to have individual privacy of their own stuff, but I think it's also important that it's going to fund on-chain transactions in the future. Because as fees go up really high, people are going to be incentivized to go to Lightning, right? Or go to Liquid or go to some other layer. And there, you know, if fees get really high, then the base layer might be starved. But with these fungibility and privacy tools, you need to do that on chain. And so I think that adds another incentive to do on-chain transactions and help miners and help pay for this whole thing. So, yeah, I think I support it 100%. I don't know what else to say about that.
I feel like there's going to be, that's an attack vector against Bitcoin. The European Central Bank came out and issued some kind of whatever statement about, I think it was actually French government, and they're proposing a new law about, you know, stricter and harsher KYC measures against cryptocurrency exchanges. I guess there were a few that were not really following the rules and hadn't been enforced, hadn't taken measures or actions against yet. And they claim that one of these exchanges was used to fund the terror attacks on France a year or two ago. And that to me is a massive attack vector against Bitcoiners. Easy to sell with politics of fear that Bitcoin is for criminals and terrorists. And that FUD has been around for a long time, but anytime I think something bad happens, there's going to be an accusation that it was funded with Bitcoin. And we all know as Bitcoiners that USD is what, you know, cash is what funds most of this, these actions, but it's going to get blamed on Bitcoin. And those narratives can be pretty strong when they get into the mainstream media, as we know.
Yeah. But, people can move, right? The businesses can move, so you can move to a friendly jurisdiction. And with VPNs and other things, like the German government or the ECB, maybe, or not the ECB, the EU government can make rules in the EU. They can't make rules in, say, Turkey or in Vietnam, right? So you just move your jurisdiction, you move your server where you're going your VPN through, and you're fine. It's going to be very hard for the government to do anything because they're so damn incompetent. Yeah, I mean, there's some of the stuff that they talk about, these central bankers talk about with the CBDCs and things, they are so far behind. It's not even 2016 level Bitcoin, it's 2013 level Bitcoin, right? Or even 2012. And so they're so far behind. I just am not worried about those incompetent government people making Bitcoin harder to use. I don't see that. If they do some sort of KYC, which would be, you know, just hitting the nail with the hammer. So let's add more KYC. No, people will route around it and it'll be super easy. None of these KYC laws have affected me anyway, because anything I use my Bitcoin for, I've always used privacy practices from the very beginning. And so I just continue to use those same practices, and whatever the government has done throughout this whole time has not affected good privacy practices. You just continue doing what you're doing, and you'll be fine, my opinion.
It's certainly become a lot easier. And so if you are listening to this and you haven't tried, you know, various privacy enhancing measures for your Bitcoin, I'd encourage you to go check things out. There's, you know, Samurai and Wasabi and other options out there, and new protocol changes that will also help improve privacy in various ways. So all of that stuff is coming, and I, you know, it's obviously important to Bitcoiners. It may not be important to Michael Saylor, and he made that clear. He's like, we just want to use this as a store of value. We're going to have to give up on the privacy fight and, the anti-government stuff. This is just an alternative store of value that can't be manipulated.
Same with Raul. Raul said the same thing, that he's like, privacy is dead, guys.
Yep.
Privacy is dead. Just get over it. Yep. Yeah. Give me a break.
Yeah. I used to think that way too, man, before Bitcoin. So that's another way that Bitcoin gave me some hope. Widespread.
Yeah. With gold, it's very hard, right? I mean, how do you go across a border with gold?
Yep.
That's one great thing about Bitcoin, is it opens up so many more possibilities for privacy and for individual freedom that gold bugs will have to get it. Come on, guys.
So if they will, they're going to come around. Everyone's going to come around. Schiff's going to buy in at 100K and capitulate because his son's going to be richer than him at some point. Maybe 500K, who knows? I would imagine Spencer stacks some sats. He's probably got access to a good amount of money in his pension fund. That's the speculative attack right there. You know, Spencer Schiff just goes, I'm going to use all my pension fund for my dad. And, you know,
that's the next flipping Spencer and Peter.
Yeah. I saw a great meme yesterday where it's like, you know, the one where it's, you know, young Peter Schiff, kind of middle-aged Peter Schiff, and then old Peter Schiff. And it's like, you know, gold is $1,700 on each of them, and Bitcoin goes from, you know, $10 to $1 million a coin or something like that. Well, someone added a second row, and it was just like a little baby swaddled up, and it was like, you know, Bitcoin $10 and or whatever, $1,000, and gold $17, and then Spencer Schiff, you know, $23K, $1,700, and then had Dan Blazerian, you know, Bitcoin $1 million, and Peter Schiff just like gray and old. And the meme game has been incredible this year.
Yes. The last 24 hours.
Just the last 24. Great. Yeah. Shout out to all the memers out there, man. Bitcoin Arsenal. Brecky, who is creative director at Swan, started this thing called Bitcoin Arsenal. You can check it out. It's swanbitcoin.com/arsenal, I believe it is. And you can jump off from there. But he's collecting in one like repository all of the best memes and making pages dedicated to the best memers out there. And there's a great Twitter account that's kind of collecting everything up at once. So anyway, Bitcoin Arsenal is fantastic, and I'm all about the memes. There's a question. So go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say that will help me out because on my newsletters every Friday, I always lead off with a meme.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I'm struggling to find a good meme. And so I had to make some myself, and I know those aren't going to be the best. And so, I'll go to Swan Bitcoin. What did you say? Swan Bitcoin / Arsenal?
Yeah, Arsenal, Bitcoin Arsenal. Okay. It's, I think it's, yeah, Bitcoin _ Arsenal on Twitter. So there's a good source there. A community resource from Swan Bitcoin. The Bitcoin Arsenal has all the Bitcoin memes you need to fight the FUD. So anyway, check that out. It's a lot of fun. There's a chat, a question in the chat. And I think this will kind of get us as a springboard into talking about shadow banking and your thoughts, contrarian thoughts about inflation versus deflation. So here's the question from MG Smith, who I see in every single chat on the Swan shows and this one. So shout out, man. Thanks for watching. Does Ansel think the EU will break up as individual countries and take different approaches to Bitcoin in the future? I guess that's also a kind of a question on about the viability of the European Central Bank.
Yeah, I think that they will break up, but it won't because of Bitcoin. It'll because of the euro.
Yeah.
So the euro is going to drive a wedge. It already has driven a wedge. You know, obviously the pigs, you have Greece and Italy and Spain and Ireland, they were real, they're bad fiscally. And so people, they had to be bailed out early on. And that caused an existential crisis in 2011, maybe 2014. So they've already had that started last year, or was it earlier this year? One of the German courts said that what the ECB was doing was outside of the treaty mandate. And so they wouldn't allow the Bundesbank to take part in that. That was supposedly overruled by the ECB, just flat out saying, you're wrong. So that causes some tensions. I mean, Germany is pretty strongly in the European Union camp, but you can see how that builds tension within that country itself amongst the bureaucrats and all that stuff. And Hungary and Poland, they're very against these type of loans, the way they're working out. And plus, like we've seen recently, the euro has strengthened, right, against the dollar. And all those PEP loans that they have to repay now, all the purchase program loans for these bailouts, have to be repaid in stronger euros. So that's not good. That means that their bill has just gone up over the last 2 or 3 months. Their bill has gone up 25% to repay those loans. So I think the euro is going to cause the breakup of the EU. And yes, Bitcoin will be right there in the mix of that, but it's mainly the euro.
Why has the euro been strengthening against the dollar over the past few months?
Because they have more stimulus. And people, it's counter to what people think. People think that stimulus causes inflation, right? But no, if you stimulate your economy, quote unquote, stimulate your economy, you have more demand for your money. So because you're kind of your business picks up, you have a little bit more economic activity. And so you have more need for euro denominated debt and also euros in general. And so that demand gets broadcast out and the euro strengthens relative to the dollar. Also, the lack of trade around, you know, this year there's been a big dip, obviously, in trade around the world. And a lot of it, like for demand in oil or other things. And you have less need for dollars in general when the economy is sliding down like this. I mean, it can go back and forth on which currency has higher demand, the dollar or the euro. But in general, over the last 2 or 3 months, since there's been more stimulus in the European Union, there's been more demand for euros. Now, when we pass this, what's the new thing that's coming out this week, or they're trying to pass it this week in Congress, the next bailout for people. We're going to see a bottom in the dollar versus the euro, and it's going to turn around because the stimulus will create more demand for dollars out there. So that's my 2 cents.
Okay. So you mentioned there that the money printing doesn't create inflation. So, and that the dollar system is not, the global dollar system or money system is not as centralized as we think it is. So can you give us that thesis?
Well, I didn't say money printing doesn't cause inflation. I said what they're doing is it money printing. If it were money printing, it would cause inflation. That's for sure.
That's the mistake that we all make. We call it money printing. Right.
Right. Yeah. And also the central banks aren't central. That's another one of the big points. So, QE is not money printing. Because they don't print dollars, they print reserves held at the Fed. And those reserves held at the Fed are non-fungible reserves. You can't buy lunch or dinner with them. They sit there at the Fed and they're just a balance sheet tool. They're nothing, they don't really exist other than on a balance sheet. So that's not money. That's just a different asset called a reserve that never enters circulation. Mm-hmm. And it can't. So that is why QE is not money printing.
Why can't it enter the regular economy? I mean, stimulus packages, loans, et cetera, low interest loans go up. Isn't that how these reserves are designed to enter the economy? Because if they don't enter the economy, there's no stimulus.
Right. Now, the way it would kind of translate into the economy is if that boosted confidence in banks to lend. But another thing I talk about is that it takes two to tango in loans. So if the interest rate is too low, lenders don't want to lend. If interest rates are too high, borrowers don't want to borrow. So it has to be in this Goldilocks zone in the middle. And if it doesn't matter, if interest rates are at zero and you bail out the banks, they're still not going to lend because it's too low. The loan is too risky for what the interest rate is that they're getting back. So you would expect QE to say, hey, the banks are more solvent, they can make more loans and expand credit in the economy. It doesn't work like that. It drives interest rates down, which makes them makes them more hesitant to lend in the first place. So
why is it typical to combine QE with lower interest rates? Because okay, so I'm assuming that they want to try to control against inflation, but if you wanted to get money out into the economy to provide relief for quote unquote Main Street and corporations who are suffering, wouldn't you increase the interest rate a little bit so the banks are loaning that stuff out?
Yes, but I might not be the best at explaining this, but if you can't raise the interest rate because there's so much debt out there, right? And the way that this, the way that the collateral, the need for collateral and the need for cash, the way that works together with the banks and everything, the interest rates are stuck. If the government came in and said, hey, we're going to raise, like Volcker did, say, hey, we're going to raise interest rates to 10%, that would crash the economy. People would default on their debt and it would still cause deflation because credit supply is credit. Or sorry, credit, money supply is credit. And so if you crash the economy and there's all sorts of defaults and people can't repay their loans, then you actually shrink the money supply. So they're stuck at zero. It's a debt trap. You can't raise the interest rates or else you crash the economy and you cause hyper deflation. And you can't lower it to stimulate borrowing because people don't want to lend if it's at zero.
How do you explain inflation in like asset prices and, you know, non-tech goods that can't be, whose price can't be deflated by, you know, production or productivity or, you know, new technologies. So healthcare, education, real estate to some extent. And then of course, like assets, equities, stock market.
Well, I mean, there's lots of different explanations for that. I mean, education, for one, has gone down to zero. Basically, it's the price of internet connection. The thing is, we've redefined what education is to only be these gatekeeping accredited institutions. Then you have to say, well, it's due to the gatekeeping. It's due to the government regulation. Same with healthcare. Healthcare costs haven't really gone up because if you just eat healthy and you live healthy, then you won't get sick as much and your healthcare costs will be low. But the problem is they have, if you eat the food pyramid and you do exactly what you're supposed to be doing according to the government, then you're going to get all these sicknesses and have higher healthcare costs. So I don't buy that healthcare costs one-to-one compared to prior decades would be higher. It's only because people are more unhealthy. Their own habits are unhealthy. Now, assets like homes is a good example. I believe that inflation or that price increase is due to there is collateral there, right? The house is collateral. So those banks don't want to lend at 0% or a 30-year mortgage at 2%, if you can believe it. So a 30-year mortgage at 2%. They don't want to lend at that rate for, say, a personal loan. But if you have a house that collateralizes that loan, that makes it less risky for them, right? And so you can see that a lot of the price increases are centered around collateralized loans, collateralized things. That can explain some of the stock market, that can explain some of other things out there. But overall, if you take it piece by piece, I think you can explain most of them. I've used this example as well. Like in a hurricane, the price of generators goes up, but it's not because of inflation. It's because you need freaking generators. The demand went up. And so a lot of these safer assets like US Treasuries or blue chip stocks, or I don't know what, they are seen as more safe. And so people flood into that and increase the demand. So that's how I explain all of those different types of asset price inflation.
I think there are, and this is the way I've understood it, and maybe I'm wrong, very likely, but the reason that there's asset inflation and, you know, these companies, there's a bubble going on because these companies are being priced at like 50x, you know, or earnings or even crazier than that. Is that these corporations do have access to loans from the big banks through, you know, the reserves that that are given to them through quantitative easing. And so they're doing stock buybacks and driving up their stock prices and, you know, parking that money where the stock market is. So it just drives up constantly. So quantitative easing seems to get through to, you know, larger corporations through the Cantillon effect, right? And keep those people rich. And we don't really get access to it.
Yes, that's exactly correct. But the money creation isn't in QE. The money creation is in the loan from the bank.
The loan, right. Yeah.
So the loan for the mortgages, that's the inflation. And that's why the housing prices go up. The loan to the company is also collateralized, right? Because debt takes priority over shareholders. So if the company was to liquidate their assets, you know, that bank would probably be made whole on that loan. So it is collateralized. There's all sorts of different things where that is the entrance point for the inflation is the loan from the bank, not the QE from the Fed. That is just a casino token that they keep on their balance sheet.
Right, right. How much money has been actually inserted into the economy out of all of this QE? If we printed however many trillions, I think it's like up to seven now or something. How much of that do we even know? Roughly how much of that is entered into the real economy?
I don't think so. Money is created all over the world. Dollars are created all over the world. So you can have a dollar denominated loan in Singapore or in Bangkok, and that adds to the supply of dollars. It has nothing to do with the Fed, has nothing to do with QE, has nothing to do with even the reserves held at the Fed. So it's very hard to know what the total supply of dollars is out there. And there's other things too. So collateral. So if I own a treasury that was just auctioned off from the US government, I can use that in a loan to get cash immediately. And almost nobody in the world would ever say no to that loan because it's collateralized by a US treasury that's as good as cash. If there's a problem with my credit, now they might discriminate against me, and that treasury, my asset that was a cash equivalent, is now not a cash equivalent anymore because people don't want to trust me. And so the banks start not trusting each other. And during the crash in March, we actually saw that the market dried up for even the most riskless of U.S. treasuries. So it was a very dramatic freeze of the credit system. And at that moment, I guess you might even say the money supply dropped to almost zero because there was no movement of money, which is interesting.
That is interesting. So is that the same as what we call velocity of money? Is that the same metric or is it slightly different? I mean, saying the money supply is zero, do you mean that the money is just like not moving? No one's willing to loan to anybody. No one's willing to move the money around, I guess.
Yeah, that means that you're not able to access capital or credit.
Okay.
And that would be mainly for the funding markets. So yeah, you could say like bank loans and maybe like M1 or base money. That was still there, but that is a very small portion of the overall money in the world. And yeah, what was the first part of that question? I forgot.
The velocity of money. Talking about the velocity of money. Yeah.
So it is conceptually related, but velocity of money is the GDP over the supply of money. And so GDP is a flawed metric, I believe. And also the money supply that they use, either M1 or M2 in that calculation, is also flawed. So velocity is really a tautology that, you know, that people wonder why, hey, we see M2 going up and velocity is diving off a cliff. Well, that's because we're in a debt trap. GDP doesn't move. And so they're inversely correlated by definition. It's a worthless formula that these central bankers think means something. So
do you think these central bankers have any like knowledge at this point, a recognition of what's happening here? Do you think at least some of them realize that everything's screwed and they're just trying to keep face until something happens? I mean, until there's some sort of new money and we reprice everything and there's, you know, debts forgiven and there's just like basically we start over like Bretton Woods.
I think they hope for that. I mean, the choice is let it burn or stagnate, you know, bail out people and let it stagnate. That's their choice that they have. They're trying to figure it out. And I think that they slowly are, because I read not all, but I read maybe 10% of what the Fed puts out. And some of that stuff, like you'll see little snippets in there. Oh, they know the funding market is central. They know the repo market is central to this. They know this, they know these different things. And, but they just haven't quite put it together into a policy. And I don't know if they can, because if they did, they would, they would probably be scared about what's going to happen. So, yeah, I think that their choice is stagnate or burn, and they're going to choose to continue, just stagnate.
Interesting. So then how does Bitcoin fit into this? If, you know, number goes up, continues to go up over time, and we're just seeing, you know, a dollar denominated economy just stagnate completely. So the people who are taking dollars and putting them into Bitcoin and are making a killing, and there's this transfer of wealth that continues to happen, and the emergence of maybe a Bitcoin based economy or companies that are running their company, you know, on a Bitcoin standard, like MicroStrategy has set the trend for, is that one of the like possible ways then that we transition to a Bitcoin, like a Bitcoin based economy?
Yeah, it's that people will look and see, oh, look, if I do a loan in Bitcoin, or if I even hold Bitcoin, or if I start a business in Bitcoin, I can make money. That's where all the growth is. And so they're going to get in to the growth story of Bitcoin. That's the next thing. It's from hodling, maybe we go into this growth story, and it's going to be juxtaposed against stagnation and just zero growth, lots of political mess. You're going to look at Bitcoin, you're going to be, oh my gosh, that is growth. It looks so serene. Mm-hmm. Everyone's so happy and cocky, and they're feeling good about themselves. And I feel like crap, and I'm depressed, and I, you know, my world sucks. I'm going to buy a little bit of Bitcoin. And even that works on the lowest of the low, but it also works on the highest of the high. They see that they have something to take advantage of. So I think that is how Bitcoin takes over. Now, one of the things I've worried about is that a recipe for inflation. Mm-hmm. So as people sell their dollars, will that push the value of the dollar down as Bitcoin is going up? You know, the speculative attack idea. I don't think that's, I mean, it might work temporarily. That might be the temporary solution. But I think long term, what's just going to happen is it's going to have a forcing effect on the size of the economy. So the size of the economy that's denominated in dollars is going to shrink. And that by definition is deflationary. Right. And so I don't think there's going to be like any sort of hyperinflation caused by Bitcoin, but it is just going to continually get smaller while Bitcoin continually gobbles up more and more.
Okay. So then, okay, let's kind of rewind a little bit. And we mentioned central bank digital currencies. We see them being worked on right now. So they're coming in some way, shape, or form. Now, this seems to make the possibility of inflation, at least in my mind, trying to understand how this works, higher if central banks are issuing digital currencies straight out into the real economy and not, you know, not putting them as credits into the banking system. Do you think that that's a risk, I guess?
Yeah, that's one of the big unknowns. We don't know exactly how they're going to do it. I think it's dangerous to do it that way. And we, like I said earlier, we've seen them even starting to shift their story now, saying this is not a replacement of cash. This is a complement to cash. Even Fed Chair Powell, he said.
But what does that mean? What does that mean? How is it different from cash? It's money, right? Or currency.
Well, it's a completely new form of money, because dollars right now, or euros or whatever, they're debt, they're credit-based money. And a CBDC is not. It's a completely new form of money that, one, who knows if they even have the permission or the legal authority to do it. And if they did, it could be very inflationary almost immediately. Yeah. And so that is, I think they're starting to grasp that this is a bad idea, and they don't want to jump into this too quickly. So we'll see. Maybe they'll try to do something small on a small scale. But also, this is an interesting kind of development is they are scared of Tether. They're scared of stablecoin dollars taking over the digital realm away from digital payments in euros or digital payments in yuan or yen. That is what they're scared of. They're actually scared of the dollar. And people aren't doing a digital euro. I mean, Tether has a euro Tether, but nobody uses it. It has like a $10 million market cap. So as you move into this new era of digital coins, you're going to see a convergence onto the dollar even more. And they're terrified of that. So I think, I don't know, you'd have to game theorize or strategize this out and see exactly what they would decide to do. But one, they're scared of doing something wrong along the way and crashing their economy. And they're also scared of not doing something. So they're in this catch 22. But where the Fed is not in that same place. You know, the Fed can sit fat and happy on the top and be like, hey, we have the global reserve currency. Tether is being the stable coin for the US dollar right now. The CBDC for the dollar is Tether. And so we don't have to worry about this. And all the other countries are going to be scared. So I don't know. That's going to be a developing story.
That's fascinating, man, that Tether could actually, I mean, be endorsed by the Federal Reserve. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me. Why wouldn't they just make their own coin, have control of it, instead of, you know, empowering a private, essentially a private company who is controlling the money?
Well, I mean, they'll hold a carrot out for Tether, probably. This Stablecoin Act or whatever that thing that just came out in the last couple of weeks, they said that this is, I just read up on it because I saw it and I said, oh, it's just another silly congressman doing something. But I read it and it said that they have to keep their reserves at the Fed, which is crazy. So that means they'll say something to Tether. They'll be like, hey, we'll give you a grace period. We'll give you some special relationships. Maybe you can have some people sit on the Fed, like on the board or something, right? Like they'll do some sweetheart deal, do some carrot to get Tether to come and hold their reserves at the Fed. And so that's how they could kind of bait these people in. And I think that's probably likely to happen.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. So if that happens, then everyone else is scared essentially because Tether can just easily, right? It has the digital currency benefit. So it's, you know, much more transportable around the world, faster, et cetera. Settlement rates are much higher, much, much quicker. And if it's based right there in the Federal Reserve, then your access to settlement, direct, you know, final settlement is much higher than it is already. So you're bypassing the middleman in much the same way as, you know, Bitcoin would.
Yeah, and they know that they're in this dollar shortage. We heard about that earlier in the year. They know that they're in this bad economic time, this deflationary environment. They're very aware of this, and they know that the dollar is convergent. Everyone's going to want the dollar, and so yeah, it's scary. Now this is kind of on the sideline to Bitcoin. Bitcoin's going to keep doing what it's doing. Every 4 years, it's going to have every 10 minutes, you're going to have a block come out. And so Bitcoin will be doing its thing and the rest of the world will be panicking and converging on the dollar.
Woo. It's fascinating, man.
Futurism for you.
Yeah. Okay. So this plays out, you know, however it does, we're not sure exactly how it's going to play out, but Bitcoin is a threat to the dollar in the long run, as you know, like we were just talking about, number go up and dollar stagnate, then, you know, it equals dollars moving more and more into Bitcoin. And I know that you're sort of skeptical about that speculative attack idea, but, or at least how often it would be used or how much it would be used. But I think once that writing's on the wall and it's much more clear, I could see things being sped up through a speculative attack, borrowing fiat at cheap interest rates and putting it into Bitcoin, knowing that the value of the dollar is going down and the chances that you're going to be able to repay that loan if you needed to, even at the after its term was up, you'd, you know, could sell off some Bitcoin and pay it off and still be way in the money and be holding Bitcoin. So let's however this plays out, it's going to be fascinating to watch over the next 10, 15, 20 years. What does a Bitcoin based economy look like to you in whenever it arrives? Oh, or if it arrives?
I think it will be smaller government, more localism. You know, like local governments might be stronger, central federal governments will be weaker. There will be obviously longer time preference. So you'll have, I don't know, it's hard to say exactly, but I do think that it will be a more peaceful world, and it will be a more productive world. Like, also one of the things about, so Jeff Booth has this idea about deflation as well, but his is technological driven. You've talked to him, a bunch probably. And, I don't think that technology will continue to go as fast. So I think we're going to be in a slower world, a more foundationally sound world, a more local world. That's what I see with Bitcoin.
Yeah, me too. Especially in regard to the change in the way that we govern ourselves, much more localism, which I think will be a massive benefit to society. Kind of return to the way that we organized ourselves for, you know, tens of thousands, 100,000 years before technologies allowed us to live in these much larger, more, you know, more centralized nation states. So I just see a happier society that is much more localized. I feel like I have a lot more control or say in school board elections, or, you know, the mayoral elections or city board, you know, the city board elections, things like that. I actually, you know, know a lot of these people and, you know, trust or do not trust them based on my, you know, direct actual knowledge of them and not, you know, TV campaigns plays, and misinformation.
My kid plays baseball with their kid, right? So like,
yeah, exactly. You have skin in the game, as you know, we like to talk about in Bitcoin. And so I think that makes a lot of sense. You decentralize the money, you decentralize the way we organize ourselves. And I think that's going to be a big benefit. And I think we'll have to work less. We'll have money that actually preserves its value. So that just really unleashes time and the ability to pursue your hopes and dreams and passions. And I think that just really... positive things can only come of that. So,
yeah. And one of the things we don't focus on very much as like Austrians or libertarians is I think wealth inequality will come down dramatically. So that's always good for a more harmonious city or more harmonious government as well, is when wealth inequality gets equalized out. And that's because sound money, you can't cheat the system where you can with the fiat money.
Yeah, exactly. And we see this in, you know, WTF happened in 1971.com. Let's go to that site and check it out. But you can see a very clear divergence in wealth inequality after we moved away from a sound money standard, at least a much more relative sound money standard, to this fiat standard. And it's just the Cantillon effects. Just enriching the rich more and more. Wages have gone completely stagnant for, you know, the rest of us, all of us plebs. And we're working 1-2 jobs, 40, 50 hours a week, just trying to get by, can barely pay down our mortgages. You have to refinance your mortgage, try to get some money to, you know, do something with, you know, pay out credit cards and all of this predatory lending. And it's a mess, man. And it's all driven by fiat money and lack of access to that money and the falling purchasing power of that money over, you know, decades really kills generations. So like, you know, this, the younger generations who haven't benefited from that money printing, you know, the boomers were still benefiting from a sound money standard when they were acquiring purchasing power and wealth. So the younger generations don't have that same purchasing power and can't buy up the you know, wealth generating assets. And so the boomers own this stuff. So it's, it is a generational wealth inequality, and it's causing a lot of, like you said, strife and misgivings and distrust and all of that.
Isn't it amazing how Bitcoin showed up right during the fourth turning? I think that's amazing.
Yeah. So are you a fan of Neil Howe and the fourth turning?
Absolutely. I think it's obviously I don't think that he's 100% correct, but yeah, I think that there is something to this generational cycle, like you were just talking about, long-term debt cycle that we can't get out of. And Bitcoin just happened to come along 10 years before shit hit the fan. So I think that is super awesome. And is it a coincidence? I don't know, because one of the things you mentioned 1971, and wasn't the first internet transmission was sent in 1969. So
sounds right.
Is it a coincidence that those things happened almost at the same time? Gold was demonetized and the internet started. So that's another thing that makes me think is, are these things coincidences? Do we have free will, or are we just on this roller coaster of the human hive mind and, just, yeah.
Yeah. Humans work. They take in, we take in information. It spreads through communication all around the world. And those needs for civilization and for individuals exist out there. There's a general awareness of them, and people start working on them. So I do agree that when you have, cypherpunk saw the writing on the wall when governments took over the money, and Hayek saw it back in the day, we're never going to get control of the money until we find a roundabout way. And the people were working on that roundabout way back in the early 80s. Chom had his eCash, and it just kept being tried over and over again for a couple decades. But the technologies to really decentralize and solve the Byzantine generals problem and the double spending problem didn't exist until, to me, the last piece of the puzzle were peer-to-peer networks, which was really like censorship resistant P2P networks. Yeah, that started with Napster, and then BitTorrent really kind of perfected it, because Napster still was a little bit centralized. And BitTorrent is a protocol that's still thriving today. It's censorship resistant. Can't stop it. And so that, to me, and that was like 2003, I think Bram Cohen started BitTorrent, kind of first released it. 5 years later, we're like, oh, hey, this tech could actually make this thing work. And it's like the missing piece of the puzzle. And the whole time, the cypherpunks were still working on this and trying to figure out how to make it happen. So it happened because we needed it. And it is fascinating that happened in 2008. I think Bitcoin was partly released because of what happened, right? And the urgency of it sort of in 2007 really became more urgent for Satoshi. And October 31st was a momentous day. There were lots of other financial news that happened that day. And then January 3rd with the London Times headline in there. So it's clear that Satoshi knew we needed this. And I think you're absolutely right that there's these, it's in the zeitgeist, the problems we need to solve. And so people see them and start working on them. And then that sort of generates those coincidences, I think. But yeah, this fourth turning coming into this very disruptive era, we're 10 years into it roughly at this point, and going to go through some major crises. But I was talking to Brandon Kittum, who is working at Swan now, leading communications. Love that guy. And he wrote a piece on the fourth turning recently. And he thinks like the most likely outcome at this point is some kind of civil war in the United States, not necessarily like a bloody guns, based war, but a war of ideas that will lead to relatively peaceful secessions. There will be, riots and conflicts and stuff, but not necessarily like a big physical war. And I don't know. I'm not, that seems unlikely to me, but it's an interesting potential outcome. What do you think about that idea?
Yeah, I think tax riots are probably the most likely thing. So like Texas will say, we're not paying any money to the federal government. and maybe South Carolina will say the same thing, maybe Florida. So, you know, I think that will kind of kick that off, but it's, I don't know. I don't feel an armed conflict for two reasons. One, because I think that the like nuclear war, we would never go nuclear in a civil war, but that it's the nuclear war has put big global conflict out of the realm of possibility. And then also, gosh, what was my second point? God, I can't remember what I was going to say now.
That's all right. It happens, man. It's all good. Yeah. I don't think armed conflict is likely either, but I can see your point about states declaring independence in a kind of a way that's not direct, an indirect way, an indirect declaration of independence. I don't know, man, if that happens, it'll definitely shake things up. And the idea of the fourth turning is, you know, we really begin to distrust institutions and kind of tear them down. And then the, you know, cycle starts over again and we start to rebuild. And then, you know, it's 80 years later, we start to distrust what we built and it's time to start over new again. And here's Bitcoin just waiting to be like, hey, here we are. I'm ready for you. I'm ready to rebuild. You can build based on me.
Yeah, I'm generally positive about the future and I wasn't as a gold bug. I think that's one of the cool things about learning Bitcoin. My boy's yelling at me. I'm sorry.
Nap time's over.
As a gold bug, I was depressed all the time. Oh my gosh. Yeah we're going to have the Civil War. We're going to have bullion and bullets and bread. That was the three B's. But now with Bitcoin, my outlook is much more bright, much more optimistic about the future. And that's contagious, man. I'll tell you, that's almost as contagious as number go up, really. That
I agree with that, man.
Bitcoin is a happy place. And so, yeah, I'm
Bitcoin
bullish.
Is hope. Bitcoin is hope. Thanks, man. I really appreciate your time. Go be your dad. This is awesome to catch up with you. I hadn't talked to you in way too long. So shill your dictionary, which is awesome, and your Patreon to support you and your podcasts.
Yep. Check out the Bitcoin Dictionary at bitcoindictionary.cc. It's 100. Jesus, boy. Terms for Bitcoin noobs or also mature Bitcoiners to add to their library. So it's a great book. And yeah, catch me at bitcoinandmarkets.com. I do a podcast there. Been doing it since May of 2016. And
yeah, man.
I do it once a week. Sorry, my train of thought is being taken by these other people.
I can't imagine.
It goes once a week and I talk about market stuff, all the stuff we covered here today. And thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
All right, man. Take care, Ansel. Thanks so much to Ansel for joining me. You can follow Ansel on Twitter at Ansel Lindner. That's AnselLindner. I am at Citizen Bitcoin on the Bitcoin Twitter. You can find the podcast at citizenbitcoin.world. You can subscribe there. Starting to broadcast some of the shows on YouTube Live. You can find that at youtube.com/citizenbitcoin. Head over there, give that a subscribe. And check those out every once in a while. Most of the shows I'm doing over there now, not every single one of them. But check out the YouTube channel. You can also check out my merch shop at layer1btc.com. Click on partners and then Citizen Bitcoin. Some cool stuff there to check out. Want to rep some Bitcoin. And there's also some OPSEC-friendly stuff that's fun. Thank you to Swan for sponsoring this podcast episode, making sure that I can continue to do this on top of the work that I'm doing at Swan, like Swan Signal Live and the Swan YouTube channel, Bitcoin TV, all of that stuff. It's awesome to be able to continue this podcast that I started well before I began working at Swan. So shout out to Corey and the squad for supporting the continuing creation of this podcast. Glad to have all of you still here and joining me on the journey. It's fun to hear from you all. on Twitter and hear that this podcast might have played a little part in your Bitcoin journey. Love to hear it. So that's it for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world. Thank you.